Ellen, that was great. I'm going to bring the discussion to a different scale, the scale of the building, of the individual building site, and what can be done in the private sector, as well as through zoning and building codes to address resilience. I have no relationships to disclose, and I'm going to talk about this in kind of three parts. First, I'm going to talk about the localized health effects of climate change is very briefly. I think that Tina did a great job of sort of setting the stage about that. Then I'm going to talk about green building design and vulnerability and the relationship between the two. And then I'll finally talk about how I think that vulnerability maps could be used to inform green building design in particular. So we'll start out talking about health effects. And I think, again, Tina sort of talked about the fact that greenhouse gas emissions are continuing to accumulate in the Earth's atmosphere. And as global temperatures rise, the negative impact of these extreme weather events, as well as other indirect effects, is projected to increase. And so, for example, this is just using some historical data from 1970 to 2010. You can see that the mortality associated with extreme weather events in Austin, Texas, and Chicago, Illinois, accounted for 84% of the natural hazard mortalities in Chicago, or 905 deaths, and 88% of the natural hazard mortalities in Austin, or 65 deaths. So we're seeing that these events that are going to continue to be a problem are already causing significant mortality in these cities. Vulnerability to these events, as Jalon mentioned, can vary significantly across a single community because of the characteristics of the built and natural environment and the characteristics of the resident population will change from one neighborhood to the next. And so it's vital that interventions designed to reduce vulnerability respond to the specific needs of their social and environmental context. From a public health perspective, localized vulnerability to climate change is comprised of two components: the ability of the population to withstand exposure to a climatic event, and the resilience of the built and natural environment to environmental disruptions, such as extreme heat, flooding, wildfire, drought, etc. By combining these two types of data into a cumulative vulnerability index, it's possible to see where social vulnerability increases or decreases a neighborhood's baseline environmental vulnerability. This slide shows two cumulative vulnerability indices that I helped develop for Travis County, Texas, a number of years ago, using some methodology that Jalon actually worked on, and in collaboration with Austin, Travis County Health Department, the Austin Climate Protection Program, and the CDC. You can see that the variables in gray introduce characteristics of the population, and the variables in green introduce environmental characteristics. The result demonstrates that by combining population and environmental vulnerability into a single index, different neighborhoods are highlighted as vulnerable to different types of climatic events. You can see that the red sort of shifts from heat to flooding, and the level of vulnerability can change, again, markedly from one neighborhood to the next. Considering the key role that the built environment plays in climate change vulnerability, I'd like to now consider how many of the strategies incorporated into the environmentally conscious or green building design, if tailored to the vulnerabilities specific to the site and surrounding neighborhood, could reduce the negative health outcomes after exposure to climatic events. This study, which I conducted as an MPH candidate at Johns Hopkins, defined green buildings as projects that were certified through the U.S. Green Building Council's Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, or LEED, rating system from 2001 to 2012. LEED is the preeminent voluntary third-party verified green building metric. Try and say that five times fast. Used in the United States, it's also used abroad, and about an average of 1.5 million square feet of construction is certified daily by the U.S. Green Building Council, well, by GBCI, which is sort of an adjunct of the U.S. GBC. LEED credits provide metrics for improving a building or development's impact on the environment. Most requirements are performance-based, which means that rather than requiring a specific, for example, roof construction, to reduce the adverse effects of the urban heat island, the requirement references a minimum performance standard of solar heat reflectance. It's therefore not possible to predict with accuracy which design and construction solutions were employed by a LEED certified project that achieved a certain credit, but it's possible to use the LEED rating system as sort of an indicator of a site or neighborhood's potential for reducing vulnerability to the adverse effects of climate change. Two recent studies carried out by the USGBC and University of Michigan, and were you a part of that too, maybe? I don't know. Identified LEED credits with the potential to reduce vulnerability to the built environment to specific climatic events. But they do not address the population vulnerability to those climatic events, and particularly in relation to the localized vulnerability of a project site in relation to health and environmental effects of climatic events. So to fill that research gap, I performed a structured literature review to identify evidence of two types of associations between green building strategies and the adverse effects of climatic events. Green building strategies that offer the opportunity to reduce the adverse effects of exposure. In other words, if there was a heat event, you wouldn't feel it as much, or strategies that offer the opportunity to shelter in place. In green building terminology, we call that passive survivability. And again, I looked at extreme heat and flooding because those were the two vulnerability maps that I was working with. I used LEED prerequisite and credit requirements as the basis for the literature review, and so that I could then apply them the results to an analysis of the level of spatial correlation between highly vulnerable neighborhoods and the density of green building project strategies in those neighborhoods. I performed the literature review by submitting queries to PubMed using National Library of Medicine medical subject headings to identify links between a LEED credit requirement and the potential impact of the strategy on risk of exposure to extreme heat or flooding, the related environmental determinants of health, and related co-benefits to public health and built environment outcomes. The heat resilience queries for the 13 LEED credits, well, I'm just going to kind of move on because I think I'm moving, I'm a little behind, but basically what you can see here is that I did identify a number of relationships in the public health literature associated with determinants of health, public health resilience outcomes, and then built environment outcomes. And I'm happy to talk about the literature review in more detail. So based on the results of the literature review, I organized a list of LEED credits with the potential to reduce vulnerability into two categories, credits that can reduce the adverse effects of exposure to the event and credits that support passive survivability or sheltering in place. Since my literature review was limited to extreme heat and flooding events, that's how I grouped the resilience credits. Using ArcGIS, I aggregated LEED certified project latitude and longitude data to the census block group level in Austin and the census tract level in Austin and Chicago because I was actually validating my results in Austin using the maps I showed you before with some of the census tract work that Jalan's group had done sort of across the country around heat, and they went down to the census tract group level. And so I removed identifying information such as the project address, project name, and owner's name. And based on the literature review, I organized a list of relevant LEED credits into four groups that you can see on the screen associated with heat resilience and then four groups of credits associated with flooding resilience. The final green building strategy data set represented the total number of LEED points in each group for each census spot group in Austin and each census tract in Austin and Chicago. Due to time constraints, I'm only going to display the results from the Austin data set, but I received similar results from the Chicago data set. I overlaid circles representing the number of LEED certified projects on the vulnerability maps and on chloropleth maps showing the density of vulnerable populations by race, age, education level, and poverty level. And then I used the frequency and summary statistics tools to create vertical bar maps, graphs describing the frequency of LEED certified projects organized by these characteristics. And this slide shows the results of overlaying the number of LEED certified projects in a census block group on top of the heat and flooding vulnerability indices. The histograms at the bottom show that the large majority of LEED projects are located in census block groups with low or no vulnerability to the events in question. I also performed a hotspot analysis to test for spatial clustering among groups of green building strategies, irrespective of their spatial relationship with the vulnerability indices. Finally, I used OpenGODA at the global level to perform Moran's Eye and at the local level to perform LISA analysis to test for spatial autocorrelation among groups of green building strategies. The global Moran's Eye results were close to zero for all green strategy groupings, reflecting no spatial clustering at the global level. The results from the LISA analysis supported the results of the global Moran's Eye test, indicating clustering in only a handful of geographic areas, which you can see shown in red on the right-hand side of the slide for three credit groupings. Furthermore, all of the neighborhoods in the LISA analysis exhibiting high local spatial autocorrelation received low rankings in the heat and flooding vulnerability indices. The study results indicate not only that the LEED projects were not targeting green building strategies with the potential to reduce vulnerability to heat or flooding, but also that they're not clustered in highly vulnerable neighborhoods in the first place. On the contrary, they are clustered in low vulnerability neighborhoods, which are arguably less in need of the potential health co-benefits they offer to building occupants and the surrounding community. It can therefore be ventured to suggest that green building projects have not been used in Austin or Chicago over the past decade as a tool to increase neighborhood resilience to the health and environmental effects of high-risk climatic events. The results of the study suggest that vulnerability maps could be powerful tools to inform land use planning and design. As a first step towards incorporating climate and health data into green building design process, I collaborated with the U.S. Green Building Council to incorporate the results of the literature review into a set of climate and health resilience collections and accompanying blog posts on their online portal for green building data called the Green Building Information Gateway, or GBIG, and it's at gbig.org. This new tool provides decision support to building projects that are located in neighborhoods that are vulnerable to extreme heat and flooding by helping them identify models for green building designs that can reduce vulnerability to those events based on the literature review. To start out, the collections focus on Austin, Texas. However, we're planning on developing additional blog posts with specific case study information that could be useful to other regions of the country. The next step would be to use a process such as a health impact assessment to organize the information obtained through GBIG into concrete design recommendations. For example, a project located in a neighborhood that's highly vulnerable to extreme heat might want to prioritize design strategies that increase vegetative cover, thereby reducing impervious surface. They might install a white roof or a vegetative roof to reduce the urban heat island effect. They might consider energy efficiency strategies that protect the building from heating up during heat waves and allow it to breathe if the electricity goes out. And they might provide enough on-site renewable power to air condition certain spaces of the building during power outages to create sort of an in-situ cooling center. And I just want to be very clear, but what I'm talking about is overlaying population data onto the built environment vulnerability analyses. And so this kind of analysis, this kind of health impact assessment, you probably wouldn't end up with those types of strategies in those locations if you weren't also looking at the underlying population vulnerability. You might start doing some of these strategies in, say, non-vulnerable population neighborhoods. The vulnerability maps on their own could be used by city departments to prioritize larger scale strategies, such as planting trees in vulnerable neighborhoods. However, as the study demonstrates, large-scale resilience planning efforts, which are occurring both in Chicago and Austin, often do not influence design decisions made at the individual building scale. So the goal of this project was to show that individual projects, if properly designed and taking advantage of some data sets that are already out there, such as vulnerability maps, could help reduce localized vulnerability to climate change if they take a proactive approach. So I want to acknowledge a large number of individuals and institutions who made this project possible. It's been a multi-year kind of epic journey. And with that, I'd like to thank you.